Molly Ball is Time Magazine's national political correspondent and a political analyst for CNN. She appears regularly on PBS's Washington Week, CBS's Face the Nation, ABC's This Week, and many other TV and radio programs. She is the author of the book Pelosi. It is just out in paperback with a new afterword, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Molly Ball to the roundtable this morning. Molly, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Wonderful to have you on the program. So initially, what drew you to Nancy Pelosi as a subject?
Frankly, I got an assignment. I took my current job as a national political correspondent for Time Magazine in late 2017. And at that point, despite having been the first woman Speaker of the House back in 2007, Nancy Pelosi had never been on the cover of any American news magazine, Time, Newsweek, U.S. News. And she also was in the middle of the news. It was going into the 2018 midterm cycle, the first national election of the Trump era. The House really the only thing in play, whether the Democrats would be able to take it. And she basically constituted the Republicans' entire campaign strategy, as she had sometimes in the past. They put her name, her face in literally millions of attack ads against Democrats across the country because of this polarizing negative image that she has with a lot of swing voters. And because of that, a lot of Democrats had grown to regard her as sort of a liability. So I wrote that profile of her that was on the cover of Time magazine in September 2018, and gained an appreciation for her story, her accomplishments. She's the sort of person, you know, everyone seems to have an opinion about, but very few Americans really know her story. So particularly after the Democrats won the midterms and she became Speaker again in 2019, it struck me that there was renewed public interest in her, and there was a bigger story that I wanted to tell and to tell in a new way, with I think more of an appreciation for her as a sort of a barrier-breaking woman and the most powerful woman in American political history, at least up to that point. So that's why I wrote the book.
So let's talk about, as you point out in the book, and you say that one of the points that you make is that the fight over the Affordable Care Act was really a defining moment of her career, legislatively speaking. Talk a little bit about that and her role in that fight and why it was such a defining moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you ask Nancy Pelosi what she thinks her legacy will be, that is the first thing that she says. And it really is what she hopes her legacy will be. You know, Democrats had been trying for nearly 100 years to enact some form of universal entitlement to access to health care. And it was on her watch that they finally got it done. And she was really instrumental. I think everyone from, you know, Barack Obama to other Republicans would tell you that they wouldn't have gotten it done without Nancy Pelosi. At the same time, most of the accounts you read of the accomplishment of the Affordable Care Act put a lot more emphasis on the Senate. And I argue in the book that part of the reason she's been, I think, underappreciated over the course of her career is that she does these extremely difficult things with such competence that she can make them look easy. But it wasn't easy. It was tremendously difficult. And I recount in perhaps ad nauseum detail just how difficult it was for her to, do all of the negotiations from the moderates to the progressives, you know, convincing both ends of her caucus to swallow some very difficult pills and to do something that was politically quite risky and that many people blamed for losing the House, losing her speakership. And she even said at the time that she thought it was important enough that it would be worth that. And she is someone who I think, you know, love her or hate her, you have to agree that she's been very effective as a legislator and someone who has always been focused on results, even when they may have political consequences.
Let's talk about that effectiveness for a moment, because as you mentioned, there have been numerous calls within her own party that perhaps it was time for her to step down. And from my read of it, and I'm oversimplifying this, of course, which is, okay, but we couldn't find anyone better, and she's really good at what she does. And that sort of dawning on members of the party that she continues to be voted as Speaker of the House.
That's right. And, you know, there have been there is a lot of angst within and there used to be a lot more, frankly, you know, especially at the time that I first started writing about her in 2017, 2018. You heard a lot of internal grumbling, and there were a lot of Democrats inside and outside the House who thought it was time for her to move on. You know, she's pushing 80 years old. She's been in charge of the House caucus along with her two lieutenants, Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn, for 15 plus years now. Isn't it sort of time for her to go? But the case that those Democrats made was always based on her public image. It was never, you never heard them saying, well, you know, we just think we could have, you know, a better person, a person who's better at doing this job. If you construe the job as, you know, running the House Democratic Caucus and running the House of Representatives overall, the concerns were always about, well, you know, the Republicans, maybe we don't think it's fair, but the Republicans have done a really good job of demonizing her and turning her into a liability for the party. So, you know, we need to present a fresh image for the Democratic Party. We need a fresh face on top of the party to send a message to the public that is different than the message that is sent by the, you know, quote unquote, San Francisco liberal Nancy Pelosi. So those were always the concerns motivating the drive to get rid of her. It was not, and, you know, I did a pretty exhaustive survey of some of the comments of her opponents, and there was not one of them who was saying that, you know, I don't think she's effective at, you know, keeping the Democratic Party together on big bills or strategizing how the caucus should determine its priorities or negotiate with the Trump administration and the Republicans. No one questioned her ability to do those things and probably do them better than anyone else. The questions were always just about her long tenure and as leader of the caucus and her negative public image.
Let us talk about the negative public image for a moment. How much of that is, I mean, you mentioned her age, which, so I can ask about ageism, but I think the more dominant, of course, is how much of it is sexism?
Well, it's an impossible question to answer, but I do write a lot about what it was like for Nancy Pelosi, you know, as a woman, as the first and to this day only woman ever to lead a party in the Congress. You know, when she came in in a special election in 1987, there were 23 women in the 435 member House of Representatives. It was only when she became Speaker for the second time in 2019 that number hit 100 for the first time, and she's been a part of that. She's recruited a lot of women to run for office. But the first time she, after a decade in the House, when she set out to run for leadership for the first time, she was running against the sort of male-dominated Democratic establishment. She was not the next in line, and she had to fight. And the word that she heard back through the House grapevine was, well, who said she could run? There was, and she was enraged by this idea that she ought to ask somebody's permission, that you know, she should have had to get somebody to say that she was allowed to do this thing that she felt qualified to do, that she knew that she had the votes for, and she felt that she could do better than anyone else. So she has always had that sense of confidence that she could do this job and get the votes to do it, and it has been in the face of some significant headwinds from, you know, this very male dominated political world that she's been in. So I don't think you can underestimate or you know, I think a lot of people maybe don't appreciate how much she had to battle to get to that position and to be the first woman in that series of positions. And then then the way that this image of hers, you know, the whole San Francisco liberal idea actually originated in the 1984 Democratic Convention in San Francisco, which was in San Francisco because of Nancy Pelosi. She was a top DNC official at the time who helped bring the convention there. And at that time, and she would argue to this day, it was really a dog whistle for homophobia. It was really the association of San Francisco with homosexuality and the AIDS crisis that was a reference to, and maybe in a larger sense, the, you know, the cultural dislocations of that time, the protest movements and Haight-Ashbury and so on. And so But the reason that she has always really resonated with people, her connection to that, I think is something that you have to see. There's something going on there, that the reason that voters, particularly conservative voters across the country, just seem to react so viscerally to the image of her in particular. And you could say, you know, there's not just her, she's not the only one sometimes in those Republican ads these days. They're still putting Hillary Clinton in the ads.
Right.
And they're putting, you know, AOC and the quote unquote squad in the ads, and sometimes Bernie Sanders. But I think there's a clear pattern, and they do it because it works, because these are the figures, the faces that get a rise out of people, that trigger the anger of a certain set of voters.
Well, and that was my next question. You're absolutely right, of course. And during this last election cycle, it seemed at times that Nancy Pelosi was on the ballot as much as Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were. And what I think is important to note is, well, they won. What is it, do you think, about her and about even how she worked things during the campaign that helped in that regard?
And they won in 2018 as well, right? I mean,
yes,
I think in 2020,
absolutely,
you could say, well, she wasn't the top of the ticket, Joe Biden was. But in 2018 also, she was much more prominent and in that strategy, and they overcame it at that time too. So to a lot of Democrats, that sort of proved that these Republican attacks had lost their bite, or at least were insufficient to overpower the Democrats' message, particularly in the age of Trump. You know, I think she became a foil to Trump in a way that I think really benefited her, that really sort of made her a hero, particularly to the sort of women-driven, quote-unquote, resistance, right? One of the things that I was so interested in from that first article I wrote about her was that at the same time as she was being demonized by the right, but also disregarded as a sort of liability by many on the left, the operative political dynamic, particularly in 2017, 2018, was a historic and unprecedented uprising of American women in politics. American women coming out of the woodwork to organize, to vote, to run for office in ways they literally had never done before. So it was sort of ironic, in my view, that the most powerful woman in American political history should be the subject of so much angst at a time when that was what was really powering the party. And the way that she faced off against Trump, that famous meeting in the Oval Office with Trump that is depicted on the cover of my book, her walking out of it in the red coat with the sunglasses, where she said to his face, please don't tell me, please do not characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting as the leader of the House Democrats. You know, those were powerful words to a lot of particularly liberal American women who had been so hungry to see someone, and particularly a woman, stand up to Donald Trump and do it to his face and not let him decide where they stood, or perhaps had ever been in a meeting with a man who tried to tell them where they stood, right? So I think she really experienced a new and unexpected chapter in her public life with the surprising election of Donald Trump. And I think that did a lot to sort of change the way she was viewed, particularly in the Democratic Party.
You mentioned that moment of her coming out of that meeting with Trump. But the other moment for me was when, at the end of Trump's State of the Union address, wearing all white and just looking perplexed and disturbed and picking up her copy of his speech and tearing it in half. To me, that just tells you a lot about the woman.
Yeah, I think it absolutely does. And, you know, there was a lot of dissection of that episode after
yes.
It happened. You know, what was she trying to do? Did she plan it? Was this some, you know, incredible chess move to try to distract from Trump's speech or so on and so forth? But I think she was telling the truth, that it was just something that she felt compelled to do in the moment. And one of the things that you'll learn from my book is that Nancy Pelosi has a temper.
Yep.
And it sometimes gets the better of her. She's a quite disciplined, quite controlled person, but she was upset with Trump. And you could see in the way that she dealt with him throughout his presidency that she was affronted. She was offended, not just by his positions on things or the things that he said, but his disrespect for the institutions, right? She's an institutionalist. She sees the House as, she's called it, a temple of democracy. And she viewed him as sort of desecrating that temple. And I think particularly with the way that the Trump administration ended and the insurrection of January 6th, this was her house that he was coming into, right? He was giving that State of the Union address on the floor of the House of Representatives, and that's her house. And she felt that he'd come into her house and trashed it. So I think she was angry at that moment that the speech she viewed as a political speech, she said at the time, full of falsehoods, also full of stunts, right? That was a speech where he had given Rush Limbaugh the medal while he was up there in the gallery. Right. So all of this she I think was personally affronted by, and that led to her making that public display.
You talk about the insurrection, and I just recall the 60 Minutes piece where she was walking through her office and showing what had happened. And I mean, it's hard, obviously, not to take that personally. But, I mean, you saw the anger that day toward her, and a lot of it was directly toward her. And that has to be incredibly scary and to rattle her. And for the immediate response, or the response then to be, okay, it's for not the first time, but for the second time, to lead an impeachment of the President of the United States.
Yeah, really a remarkable episode. And of course it had to have been scary. Of course it had to have been, she had to have been shaken by it, as so many members and their staffs and people who were in the building that day were. But at the same time, Nancy Pelosi is someone known for being tough, and she deserves that reputation. And she has been the target of just an absolute fire hose of hatred and vitriol and, you know, insults and threats. And some of it's fair. Politics ain't beanbag. But a lot of it is, you know, just real nastiness and threatening and dangerous. So I don't think it was news to her that there were people out there, unfortunately, who wanted to harm her specifically, and people who harbored this extremely visceral, you know, people who see her as un-American, as a traitor, as the source of, you know, the prop, everything wrong with this country. It's certainly not news to her that there are people who feel that way, unfortunately. And so I think It does tell you something about her that her first resort was to the institutional tools at her disposal, right? To say, all right, the Constitution says if a president does something like this, this is how we respond to it. This is the instrument of accountability that we have, and that's as much as we can do.
One of the things, Molly, that is fascinating in reading your book and the 320-plus pages and the new afterword is that when you finish, you realize, well, she's not finished. She's not done. She's still going. And there's a lot more to be written about Nancy Pelosi.
That's right. Although I think she is nearing the end of her public career. She tries not to engage on the question very much, but she has indicated that she does plan to abide by the term limit she set for herself, which means that she would step down at the end of the current term in 2022. And she has been, you know, thinking about her retirement for some time, even if she doesn't like to talk about it, she doesn't want to lame duck herself. But I think she's someone whose significance will be more and more appreciated as the years go by. I think her impact on American political history, the liberal accomplishments that she's been a part of, and her historical significance as the first woman Speaker of the House, and her effectiveness in doing so. You know, I'm not a historian or a political scientist, but I've talked to a lot of them, And they will tell you that she belongs in that pantheon of sort of legendary congressional leaders. She belongs up there with an LBJ, a Sam Rayburn, a Tip O'Neill. People may not think of her that way today, but I think as the years go by, people more and more will see that she is one of the great congressional leaders, whether or not you agree with the things she's tried to do.
So let's say she goes with her original plan of retiring at the end of this term. Still a lot going on over the next year and a half plus. Finally, let's just characterize that relationship with Joe Biden as how you see it, and how that partnership, for want of a better term, can work.
Well, it seems to be working pretty well so far. You know, there's a lot in the book about her relationship with President Obama and her sometimes frustration with the Obama administration. You know, President Obama had come in as an anti-establishment candidate who said Washington was broken and we had to, you know, chart a new way forward. And so maybe not to him, but to a lot of the people around him, she seemed like sort of a dinosaur, right? The dreaded quote-unquote career politician. Well, Joe Biden's one of those too. He's someone who spent decades in Washington learning the ropes of the Senate. And so I think they see eye to eye as institutionalists and as creatures of their respective institutions in Congress and as students of Congress. And we've seen them work together effectively on the first big bill. And she's got the House churning madly, aggressively pushing out legislation that she hopes the Senate can then take up and consider. You know, she always sees herself when there's a Democratic president as a partner, not a lieutenant. She's part of these decisions. She has a role to play in the shape of things that get passed and the priorities that are moved forward. It's a relationship that seems to be working together very well so far. So we'll just see in the coming months. You know, the conventional wisdom is, and I think it's probably correct, that Biden's going to have a lot more problems with the Senate than he is with the House. Even though she's got a very narrow majority to work with, and it is quite difficult to get things through the House with that math, it's the Senate that I think is going to give this administration a lot more headaches.
Molly Ball is Time Magazine's national political correspondent. She is the author of the New York Times bestseller Pelosi, which is now out in paperback from Picador with a new afterword. Molly Ball, thank you so much for being with us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Pelosi, by Molly Ball. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.